Thanks for tuning in to another broadcast of Who Judges the Judges here on WLJA Radio. Our website, WLJARadio.net, and the email address, Catherine Hine at WLJARadio.net. Now, here's Catherine.
Hello, radio listeners, to another broadcast of Who Judges the Judges. We're privileged to have with us today Neil Brick of the organization SMART, which is an organization to stop ritual abuse and child exploitation. We're going to be talking with Neil Brick about the upcoming conference on ritual abuse that is going to be taking place in August in the state of Connecticut, I believe. Neil Brick is the founder of SMART, which stands for Stop Mind Control and Ritual Abuse Today. To discuss the scientific information that is out there in some abundance about ritual abuse crimes and what happens in the courts, what happens in therapist offices, what is happening with the current state of scientific knowledge about these crimes. I think that maybe to start with, we want to just get into an area that more people are familiar with, and maybe to distinguish between ordinary child abuse, I guess if we can ever call child abuse ordinary, and ritual abuse. Could you kind of ease us into this topic that way?
Sure, I'd be more than happy to. Hi,
Rick?
My name's Neil Brick. I'm with the organization SMART, Stop Mind Control and Ritual Abuse Today. Everything we're discussing tonight, as far as I know, you'll be able to find on our website. It's at Ritual Abuse, one word, RITUALABUSE.US. And what I'm going to read now is at our Ritual Abuse tab at that website, where we cite a variety of research articles and some links to legal cases as well involving ritual abuse crimes with convictions. I'm going to read you a definition of ritual abuse that comes from a book written originally in the 1990s called Safe Passage to Healing. It was a book written for survivors of ritual abuse, written by a woman named Christine Oksana, C-H-R-Y-S-T-I-N-E, Oksana, O-K-S-A-N-A. It was originally published by HarperCollins as a newer edition out by iUniverse.com. It's called What is Ritual Abuse? I'm going to read a direct quote from page 3536 of that book. Is methodical abuse, often using indoctrination, aimed at breaking the will of another human being? In a 1989 report, the Ritual Abuse Task Force of the L.A. County Commission of Women defined ritual abuse as ritual abuse usually involves repeated abuse over an extended period of time. The physical abuse is severe, sometimes including torture and killing. The sexual abuse is usually painful, humiliating, intended as a means of gaining dominance over the victim. The psychological abuse is devastating and involves the use of ritual indoctrination. It includes mind control techniques which convey to the victim a profound terror of the cult members. Most victims are in a state of terror, mind control, and dissociation. And though there are many other definitions of ritual abuse, that's a pretty good one.
Okay, so the purpose of, from the standpoint of the perpetrator, is to control the mind of another person, usually a child. Right?
That would be part of it. It depends on the perpetrator, of course. If they're looking to control people to use them to continue the cult actions, then that would definitely be one aspect, just to control the child to become a member of the cult later. Absolutely.
I understand that there's a particular, like physiologically, that there's a particular age that a child is when abuse will shatter the child's personality so that the child becomes what used to be called multiple personality disorder, now then later became dissociative identity disorder. Is that accurate?
Yes,
is there a specific time, I think before the age of seven?
Yeah, before the age of six, severe repeated abuse will cause many children's minds to literally split. That's where we get the prior term in the DSM was multiple personality disorder. Now it's called dissociative identity disorder. And that's where that the mind literally has to split to escape from the severe pain and torture. There's a lot of research backing up this phenomena. You know, they've looked at documented cases of evidence and then documented symptomology to prove that this exists. So,
how is it really possible to prove that multiple personality disorder or dissociative identity exists?
Well, you would prove depression would exist, or bipolar would exist, or schizophrenia.
Right.
It's a solidly documented disorder. There are a variety of research studies that would measure symptoms. What's more interesting is they've actually done neurological, a variety of brain-based and physiological studies on eyesight and handedness and actually even looking at scans of brains to show different alters. So there's been a physiological component to the research proving it exists. But also, you know, just looking at a symptom panel, it's very consistent through all the sufferers of dissociative identity disorder. It's a good question, though.
Yes, I understand there was a researcher at Harvard or one of those northeastern schools that
there's a lot of them.
A number of them that actually shows
there, yes.
the physiological changes in the brain that occurred. I thought that was because of any child abuse.
There also is any child abuse as well. Let's see. Child abuse, definitely, they've done...
Is it just a form of child abuse?
They've looked at child abuse, basically. There's the ACE studies, I believe, I think it's by the CDC or by people connected to the CDC. And those studies showed that child abuse, the more child abuse and child neglect factors you have and disadvantageous child abuse experiences you would have, the more chances are you'll have a child who becomes addicted to a substance as a grown-up, as an adult, has a variety of psychological disorders, you know, increased chances of early pregnancy, criminal histories, a variety of, biological disorders and diseases as an adult. So that's a good point, too. But what we're more focusing on in this case is how the severe abuse actually splits the mind.
Okay. When a person, where I'm familiar with, I have run across this, I wouldn't say I'm familiar, but I have run across what I thought was ritual abuse when I used to practice law, where the children were being ritually abused. It seemed they were telling the protective parent about being locked in cages, and of course there was sexual abuse with it. But to try and establish that in a court of law is difficult because you're always dealing with hearsay from the child victim who is reporting to the non-offending parent.
Well, the question is it hearsay if they directly experience it? I would think not. I mean, it's direct testimony. You know, and if you get several children saying the same thing, like a good example is with a lot of the clergy abuse cases we have now, we'll have 5, 10, 20, 30 or more children sometimes coming forward saying this priest did this. Or like with the Bill Cosby situation. I mean, we can go with the Jerry Sandusky situation. We can go on and on and on. The more children as adults we have coming forward and basically listing the same stories over and over again in different settings. Makes the allegations much more credible. And so that's Well, oftentimes what we have in ritual abuse, we'll have certain groups and there will be many people coming forward. Ritual abuse is harder to prove because of the secrecy in which it's perpetrated. I mean, with the Catholic Church, for instance, they documented everything. I mean, so that made it easier when people went to court, your lawyers would subpoena the papers right in discovery, and then they would have a lot more information saying they actually talked about the person and the children, and that was huge. Of course, in ritual abuse situations, that's different. Evidence is often destroyed purposefully. Bodies are ground up. Oftentimes they'll have lookouts to make sure no one's coming to the area and so on. And then with the severe dissociation, by the time people remember these crimes, it could be 20 or 30 years. That's oftentimes how dissociation works. The child dissociates to be safe as a child, because they know if they come forward as a child, they could be killed or abused further. But once they're an adult, they start to talk, but then that's 20, 30 years later. A lot of times the physical evidence is long gone. The children are often separated out geographically into different areas as adults. So it's a greater challenge, of course, legally. Absolutely. But still, there have been a lot of cases. Sometimes the smaller ones, but there have been a lot of cases where children have come forward. The daycare cases are good examples of that. There have been some.
Yes, let's talk about the daycare cases. I'm somewhat familiar with the McMartin and the Franz daycare cases, and if you could tell us.
Well, the McMartin case was probably the largest case of all, obviously, and it's unfortunate how it got horribly spun to being some sort of bizarre panic or something. If you look at, there was this great bias. If you look at the what was going on in the media in the 80s, I mean, every article I've seen basically presented both sides of the argument fairly well. I mean, there may have been some TV, sensationalization here and there. But there were a lot of children coming forward with a lot of documented physical abuse in McMartin, plus the tunnels were found. So there's been, obviously research going the other way on that. But, one example about McMartin that's interesting was that this is a really good book, Behind the Playground Wall, Sex Abuse in Preschools by Jill Waterman et al., published in 1993. There were a variety of jury trials, and this wasn't some panic. Was actually, there was a great deal of evidence showing what had happened. And the juries were landed to a deadlock, however, and they failed to find a verdict several times. But in one of the trials, 9 of the 11 jurors who agreed to be interviewed indicated that they believed the children had been molested. However, the evidence didn't enable them to state beyond a reasonable doubt who perpetrated the abuse. So this is an LA Times article it came from. Another article that was in the New York Times from 1985, the prosecutor said they intend to present as witnesses 41 former pupils of the school, almost all of whom physician testified at the hearing showed physical evidence of having been sexually abused.
Wait, which case was the 1985 one that was reported on in the...
That was a New York Times article, February 13th, 1985. Yeah, the article is called Reporter's Notebook, 6 months of California Case. So there was a lot of evidence. I think what happened was, there were stories that the prosecuting attorneys didn't do the job they needed to do to win this case. I'm not so sure if that's true or not, but that's what I've heard. Later cases like the Amaral case and so on were more solidly put together from what I've heard. So that the allegations stuck to this day,
There were going back to McMartin, or I guess in general, any daycare case, it would seem that your evidence would get stronger because the victims would not know each other, and so that would defeat the defense that, well, these children got together and...
Well, absolutely.
And... And if got their story straight.
And if they were talking correctly.
With the help of a therapist.
Yeah, if the therapist did the job correctly and didn't lead the children, which is often what happened, especially in later cases, they were more careful If the therapist didn't lead the children and the police didn't lead the children, but let the children just talk, and they started to find similarities in their stories, that would give them a lot more to go to court. So, I mean, the bottom line is these cases, you know, were spun later, after the fact. I mean, many of them were spun, especially the ones with, you know, seemed to have like a satanic edge of some sort. But the daycare cases in general got spun a lot, and you know, sometimes the people were released on technicalities, you know, not because the evidence was bad. Ross Scheidt did a really good job at looking at these cases more recently in a book. R-O-S-S-C-H-E-I-T. He did a really good job at looking how there was not really a panic in many of these cases. The parties were probably guilty, you know. So, I mean, again, the overt, you know, slant that, oh, it was a panic and a horrible miscarriage of justice, for the most part, wasn't true at all. There's a lot of strong evidence in most of these cases. One really good case is the West Memphis 3. That's been written about more than anything else. And there's a great deal of information on both sides of the line, guilty or not guilty. To this date, I mean, they were found guilty, but, I mean, they were released on what's called an Alford plea. I'm sure as an attorney you're familiar with that. And so technically they're still guilty, but they're just on, like, 10 years of probation now at this point. And that was a very interesting case, but at the same time was very misrepresented by the media and, you know, TV, movies, and so on. Because if you dig into the case and you look at what really happened, you know the mental health of Eccles and how he was found near the scene after the fact, and you could go on, and how Miss Kelly confessed numerous times to all sorts of people when he was not even forced to at all. You know, but people don't know that side. What happens is we get a media that pushes this side, oh, panic, and that's it, you know. So what we get is an incorrect view of what really happened in all of these court cases. And what really happened is there's a lot of strong evidence that these people were guilty at times, depending on the case.
Most of these are criminal cases, aren't they?
Yeah, I think so. They're obviously child rape, and occasionally West Memphis 3 was also murder. Most of the day cases were at least child rape. So, yeah, there were no real civil cases that I can recall in terms of the...
I always have thought that it should be in a civil case that children would be more easily protected, because the burden of proof is less, nobody's going to go to the penitentiary. It should be easier to protect a child from abuse of any kind in a civil case.
And that's a good point. Bill Cosby is an excellent example.
In reality, it works the opposite. In civil cases, especially divorce cases, the judge puts more of a burden on than it would even be required in a criminal trial.
That's interesting. I think it depends on the case. You know more about it. You're a lawyer. I'm not. But I know, like, with Cosby, for instance, I mean, that's really where they're going. Once the statute of limitation runs out, they can go civil. And I guess that's a big one. And now he may be caught criminally as well. One of the cases did not run past the statute of limitation, so that's running right now, I believe. But that's a very interesting point. You know, there are different ways to find justice in the system for these crimes. You know, so you made a good point there.
Okay. What about the case that came to light involving public officials out of Nebraska? John DeCamp wrote a book about that.
Oh, the Franklin case?
The Franklin cover-up case.
The really good information on that that's been presented at our conference was by Nick Bryant. He has written an excellent book on that. Nick Bryant really, and he has a lot of trouble getting his information out. he believes, and I agree with him, that it was really covered up. You can find it, our major pin in our website. He did a presentation at a 2013 conference, the Franklin Scandal, the Continuing Cover-Up. Mick went all over the country to figure out what happened in this case. There is a PowerPoint at our website of the presentation where he goes over the basic parts of the case. I mean, he came in after the camp, of course. This article...
One of the problems that seems, that at least always came up with the work I did, was the interference by the false memory syndrome people who are closely tied to NAMBLA. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, I'm not sure if that's true or not. I mean, I've heard allegations of such, but I don't know if the NAMBLA correct connection is accurate or not. Obviously, you know, you find that more in the UK, actually, with the PIE being connected to organizations more closely there. I think it's called the PIE. But definitely the false memory syndrome people and the group, which is kind of like they've kind of aged out at this point mostly, though their work is continued by younger skeptics, often working independently, but not always. With them, they obviously, you know, they were one of the major progenitors of the media change. Up till 1992, 1993, this is extremely well documented. The media was very sympathetic to hearing stories of child abuse, ritual abuse, and so on. Within a year or two, that totally swung. The false memory syndrome put a lot of pressure, you know, as per some of the media sources, on them. Certain stories got squelched. The false memory syndrome then went into went more into the legal arena and started to go after people. Therapists were gone after. Those are the reports. If you look at my front page, there are a couple of people. One good source is Anna Salter and Ralph Underwager. Ralph Underwager was, in my opinion, one of the founders of... he came out of the 80s, but he also was one of the founders of the false memory syndrome. He ended up basically getting shut down because he went to Europe in 1991 and did an interview with a newsletter called Podaika, which is kind of a pro pedophilia. I think it was Dutch, I believe, Dutch newspaper. And he was in Amsterdam. And he basically makes the statements, pedophiles can boldly and courageously affirm what they choose. I'm reading a direct quote here. They can say what they want to get to find the best way to love. And he just goes on with this. And he didn't, my guess is he didn't think that it was going to make it back to the States. Of course it did. At that point, he kind of had to leave the False Memory Syndrome Foundation because that was just too much. There's been a lot of critiques of the false memory syndrome people, their research, this so-called syndrome not being scientifically proven, at times allegations of harassment. One person who states he was harassed by them and people connected to them, I think it was David Kaloff. We connect to one of his journal articles at our website. Notes from a Practice Under Siege, Harassment, Defamation, and Intimidation in the Name of Science. It was in Ethics and Behavior in 1998. So there's a copy of this. I had permission to put it up from him at our website. And there were other cases of people being, you know, harassed, shut down in various ways, the media being kind of, in my opinion, co-opted. It's a real good article. Let's see if I can find it. This is the 90s, was where everything swung around to like, oh, they're all crazy kind of thing, you know, instead of like having a legitimate view of trying to look at both sides and find an accurate opinion on things. Let's see if I can find any of the... Here it is. There's a real good article written in 1997 in the Columbia Journalism Review by Mike Stanton called U-Turn on Memory Lane. And he really looks at looks at it. We have a link to the article in the webarchive.org page.
I think I just, U-Turn on Memory Lane by Mike Stanton.
Yes, and it's the FMSF builds much of its case against recovered memory by attacking a generally discredited Freudian concept of repression. The proponents of recovery memory didn't buy either. And he goes on. The article is really good, and he shows how things really got swung. Another good article, less famous, obviously, was one written by Noel Packard, Battle Tactics of the False Memory Syndrome Foundation, written in 2004. It's also linked to it on our website. In general, that's one thing our website does, is tries to show what happened during that time period, where the changes became, and a lot of the pseudoscience on the false memory side of the line. I mean, one of their things is, oh, we don't have any evidence on our side, which isn't true, of course, and you can tell from my website. If you go into a list of ritual abuse references, I have hundreds of journal articles and references backing up what we've done from a variety of scientific journals from the United States, Europe, and so on, backing up what we say. A lot of links to articles when we can link to these articles when they are free. One real good source for if people are looking for a quick synopsis, I know this is kind of complicated, we're talking a lot about research and scientific evidence, it's called childabusewiki.org, and there's not a lot of articles there at this point, but there's ones on ritual abuse, the extreme abuse surveys, and so on dissociative identity disorder, really listing the articles in an easily readable form. It's kind of the answer to other wikis out there that are run by skeptics that only present one side of the argument, the other side. So that's a real good source, childabusewiki.org. People can look that up, and then they can go to articles on ritual abuse, dissociative identity disorder, and so on. For well-documented information on these cases, that's the issue. So, to this day, I mean, there's still a lot of harassment. It's, you know, at our website, people can find out more about, you know, things that are going on now and how they can help get the information out, so on. But the main thing is that the research is still out there and it's available to people. That to me is the most important issue. So
is the FMSF still going pretty strong? I noticed that in I think Mike Stanton's article, he pointed out how well funded they were back then.
That was 1997. Keep in mind, almost 20 years ago.
Yeah,
I think they're not totally defunct, but they're kind of on the retirement side. They're a lot older now. They're in their 60s. Or 70s, a lot of the people. Some of them have passed away. So it's kind of like now what's going on is the research is just being carried. Occasionally have someone coming and doing something, but for the most part, the research has been carried over. Occasionally you see a puff piece written from their perspective where they don't interview anyone from our side, and then it'll be circulated around, or someone will put out a book about how their side was right and without presenting any of our argument, and then it'll get cited all over the media. There's several books like that. But for the most part, I don't think there is a major organization right now. No, not like the False Memory Group, anyway.
To what do you attribute that? They've already won, maybe?
Well, I don't think they already won.
Sports?
You know, I mean, the media, you know what the media is. The media is controlled by interests, by people who have a lot of money. It's in the media's interest. I write a lot about this to keep things like what Richard B. Survivors have gone through under cover. You know, it's to their best interest. If people realize how they can be indoctrinated through propaganda, you know, to have a certain opinion about the government, about economics, and so on. If people start to realize they're being conned and fooled, that becomes a big problem for those in power. So the idea is don't let that information get out. You know, we see this in all areas of the media, you know, about war. You know, it's not just about ritual, it's about war, it's about economics and so on, medical care. You can look in any aspect of the media and see this. It's not a new concept.
So what has happened to these children who have been ritually abused and then they grow older?
What happens to them? Well, it depends.
Yes.
If they get help, it's like any trauma victim. If they get adequate help, work through the memories in safe settings, they can live full lives or fuller lives. I mean, some people have gone through severe trauma or have disabilities of some sort. It really varies. And some, you know, like me,
do
service.
But what kind of help is really out there?
Huh? I didn't hear you.
What kind of help is really out there for ritual abuse survivors who
are
struggling?
There are therapists out there working on trauma, not necessarily ritual abuse, but PTSD, dissociation and trauma. And they're doing some really good work at this point, helping people. Ritual abuse is obviously a specific form of trauma, so if a person's a specialist, that's more helpful. But there is information out there at our website under, let's see if I can find books here.
Under what?
Under books. There's a books tab. We're simply a research and educational organization. There's no treatment in our group but we do have references to a wide variety of sources. If you go on books on ritual abuse, it's basically you have to scroll down the right a bit and click on the word books. That's about half to three quarters of the way down the page.
From the homepage.
Then you see a wide variety of books. One really good one is one real good publisher is Karnak Books, KARNAC, out of the UK. They publish some excellent research on dissociation and ritual abuse. Good book is Forensic Aspects of Dissociative Identity Disorders. That's a research book. Another excellent book that documents basically ritual abuse and government mind control. What this book's about is it's by two sisters, Cheryl and Lynn Hersha, and what the two co-authors did with them was help them document everything they went through. They would go to certain places to prove that the abuse occurred. They said there's no way they could know about this place unless they'd been there, and so on. They also go through a lot of the government paperwork they got released through Freedom of Information Acts and so on. It's called A Secret Weapons by News Horizons Press. You can still find some copies online. And then there are a wide variety of books we list at the website that can help survivors, work through what they've gone through. However, the caveat is always you can try to find a safe person to work through the trauma with. That's very important, professional. And as I scroll down this page, Allison Miller is another excellent person out of Canada who is a psychologist who has worked with mind control, ritual abuse mind control victims, done excellent work, and published a lot of her work. Another person who's done more of the research side, but also has done some of the mental health side is Randy Noblet, or Dr. Randall Noblet. He has the famous called Ritual Abuse book.
He's written about the Franz daycare case, right?
Yeah, he ended up in the middle of that because he was in Texas at the time, so he testified in that case, and unfortunately he's been attacked, but if you really read the article on our page, you'll see that those attacks are unwarranted. They really tried hard in that case to make sure that children's testimony was not contaminated. In the 90s, they kind of learned from some of the mistakes that are alleged to have been made in the 80s about contaminated testimony. So in the 90s, they were much more careful on how they interviewed the children, keeping children separate, and so on. The Franz daycare case, which you mentioned you were interested in before, let's see if I can find that here. So I guess the Kellers were finally released, but the case is not going to be reconsidered, so at least at this point. And if you look at the website, I really try to be accurate here. That's important. Everything I put on this page is as well documented as possible, well researched as possible. And if anyone knows of a discrepancy, people, we definitely try to update this. There's no name calling, no insulting, no taking a step beyond what we've documented with the research and the media. It was in 1992, and he was a consultant on the case, I guess. I think he testified as well. And if anyone would know about the case, he would, because he participated in it, and not the people who come later, that, in my opinion, have tried to spin it, There were certain things that happened in the case that are very interesting. The children, were wearing their clothes inside out, wearing other children's underwear. I mean, just bizarre things that in a daycare wouldn't be happening at all. Children were coming forward speaking about sexual assaults. The Kellers fled. In a lot of these cases, the people don't flee. They fled. The Franna bleached her hair.
Yeah.
They were all wearing disguises. There's a third co-defendant who turned state evidence. I think later he claimed that he it wasn't true, but I'm not sure about that. But he pled state evidence at the time, so there was a third person involved. Ritual abuse wasn't a major part of the case till it came up later in the case. So it wasn't, and they did that on purpose, because unfortunately it's harder to believe that what they major what they mostly want is a conviction. It's very true that people will do anything to children at times, unfortunately, but they were trying to stick with the more straight sexual abuse kind of things at first. So this is a really good article.
I had a friend with a child that was at that daycare.
Huh?
And she was an attorney, and so was her husband. And,
oh, really?
Their child was not there very often.
Uh-huh.
He was only there like 2 or 3 days a week for just a few hours, just a very few hours. But he was very, very damaged and emotionally. For years.
It's a severe type of trauma.
Of,
the things that were done to these
therapy.
Children are horrible,
So you can imagine children who were there all day, every day.
Yeah. No, that's the sad part about all this backlash, is these people are getting away with these horrible crimes when they're being found innocent, or at least being released, even though in this case they weren't found innocent. They were released because I guess the conviction was overturned, actually. But the interesting thing is they overturned the conviction just based on the one piece of evidence of sexual assault by a doctor, and they didn't. There was all sorts of testimony and other evidence that wasn't used. So, but they've never, I guess at this point, they've never been found innocent. The convictions were overturned due to that one thing. People can read the page. It's on our website. It's called Franz Daycare. It's about the Keller case.
You've been doing this work for, what, a couple of decades now?
Yeah, and it's important. The work is crucial, that the history is written correctly here, that it's not spun and mischaracterized, that accurate information is out, and it's not just one-sided, it was a panic, it was a miscarriage of justice, when in reality, a lot of these cases were very solid cases with a lot of strong evidence. And just through repeated appeals, at times these people finally were released, even though, if you read the trial transcripts on some of them, it appears like they were guilty, or at least had committed the crimes. So I think that's crucial, that the history is written correctly, that these people who hurt these children this badly are not just, absolved incorrectly. And what happens is that when that happens, the people resolve of crimes they shouldn't be absolved of, that weakens other cases, and it can be used against other children. You know, now if a child walks into a court saying this happened in a daycare or in a cult, I mean, you, as a lawyer, probably burden of proof might be higher. I don't know. You know, you may have less chance of winning the case because of incorrect reporting of these cases in the media. So what the result is that children may get kept in a situation like this, or a perpetrator may continue to be allowed to abuse children when they shouldn't be. So that's why an accurate accounting of all these cases is crucial, and that's what I try to do. Obviously, I'm presenting the victim side on my webpage of these cases, but there's plenty of the alleged perpetrator's information out there already. So this is a balancing research per se. But that's the important thing, is to make sure that, you know, the record is written correctly so that the child abuse crimes don't continue. And that when they come forward, when a new crime comes forward, it's heard properly.
I get the impression, I don't know if it's accurate or not, you tell me, that an elaborate prosecution of multiple defendants with multiple victims in a daycare case is probably unlikely to happen, at least with the frequency today that it did back in the 90s.
Maybe. I think it would depend on the amount of evidence. We still see them today. You know, not sometimes multiple victims, but if you go, you just type the word child abuse in any search engine, a lot of cases are coming up. But usually they are more like a foster home kind of thing, or institutional setting with teenagers being abused. What we're seeing a lot in the United States, I think it's behind the times. In the UK and Australia, they're having major media articles and hearings on institutionalized abuse that's gone on for years in the Catholic Church and institutional settings with famous people and so on. It's huge. But for some reason, our country isn't really doing any of that. I mean, a little bit. You've got Epstein, maybe, and some of the famous people tied to him, allegations of Clinton, allegations of Trump, and so on. But you've got Cosby, Michael Jackson. There are a few, Sandusky, you know, and that being kind of covered up now.
A clergy abuse case, when we've had people on this broadcast that have SNAP and Survivors Network of those abused by priests. Those aren't invariably ritual abuse cases just because the person's a member of the clergy. But I suppose sometimes they are.
It would depend on how you define ritual abuse. There was one crossover. There's been more than one crossover. What was it? Oh, man. It was in Louisiana. It was a church that basically started, I'm trying to remember the case. Let's see if I can find it. I'm going to go to the Child Abuse Wiki page, because they have some nice cases there. And childabusewiki.org. Let's see if I can get in there and try to find ritual abuse. So here's the Ritual Abuse and Child Abuse Wiki, where there are two nice definitions. This is easy to read. My page is ritualabuse.us. Is kind of just a bunch of references kind of put together one after another. This is actually more readable in a wiki form. The page has 47 references. The bibliography, I think, is about 30 books. Let's see if I can find the case.
And I'm somewhat familiar with the documentation of child abuse that has been done by Lloyd DeMause.
Yeah, he was in the early 90s. He did some really good work on how pedophilia is not the exception, but the rule, basically. And he goes through a lot of interesting cases to do that. Let's see if I can find. I'm gonna try one more place here.
Well, he does more than just talk about ritual abuse. I mean, he points out maybe that history is dictated more than we might think by the psychopathology of maybe.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, if you abuse people, they're easier to control. They're more scared. They're more suggestible. They're more dissociative. They're going to be more addictive. So, I mean, there's definitely a sad kind of reasoning for possibly that kind of thing continuing. Yeah, it's a human Louisiana. It was an interesting case. That's the one I'm trying to think of.
Documentation by the Journal of Psychohistory or anybody about the theory that we're generally going to have politicians, probably in any country, but it's like especially in the United States, that are pedophiles because they are easily controlled. They're blackmailable.
Yeah, England's a good example because right now they're coming across so many politicians who were raping a lot of children for long periods of time. The whole Jimmy Savile thing, he was like Dick Clark in our country. Of course, Dick Clark, as far as I know, was not a bad person here, but he was kind of the big music person in that country for years, even having children's shows. It found he had hundreds of victims, maybe thousands of children he abused in a variety of settings. And after that, in England or the UK, at that point, a lot more politicians started to come down as serial pedophiles, basically, several. A lot of them have passed away. There was a lot of 60s, 70s, and 80s people. At our website, we have a couple articles about Lloyd DeMouse. I had permission to put them up from the Journal of Psychohistory. One is the history of child abuse. One is the universality of incest. I think they were both written in the early 90s by Lloyd DeMouse. And he goes through the history of how often it occurs, basically, in certain cultures. That's really good research. But, I mean, if you remember 60 years ago, they were saying incest was like, what, one in a million? Incredible denial of child abuse.
Yeah, I
crime.
Think I remember seeing some statistics
odd,
like
bizarre,
that.
Bizarre, you know. And, you know, even if, you know, you weren't supposed to talk if it did happen, you know, it was pushed under the rug, buried, no one was held accountable. Same with domestic violence, rape, you know. And then there was a kind of, it's historic. A lot of these are historic in the 70s and the 80s. Things started to come forward, thank goodness. People started to realize that it was anywhere from 1 in 5, 1 in 3 to 1 in 6 or 1 in 7 children, depending on the gender and the study, were being sexually abused before the age of 18 or raped. You know.
Mm-hmm. Or being abused or ritually abused?
Sexually abused.
Okay, right.
Yeah, I thought it was more than a girl. A subset of sexually.
One in four or something, isn't it?
Huh?
I was thinking one in four girls.
One number that's brought up oftentimes is one in four, that's correct. You know, women, they say one in three. Some people say men, one in five or one in six. Depends on the study. But the numbers are huge. That's the point. And how many people are getting treatment? Not too many. And how many people are coming forward and, you know, and dealing with it? Very few. And the research clearly shows that it leads to, you know, high addiction rates, you know, high crime rates and so on, high poor health, you know, those kind of things. That's been proven. And ritual abuse, obviously, people who have been ritually abused come out with even more issues, lower levels of functioning oftentimes because of the severe torture, trauma, and dissociation.
I do another broadcast about the state psychiatric system, and I've noticed before that it seems like systematically in that system, even though it's known that trauma brings people to psychiatry, the system does not address trauma. They talk about we have to do more trauma-informed care.
I think trauma-informed care isn't everywhere, unfortunately, but I think it's becoming more and more, with PTSD becoming a very acceptable diagnosis at this point, I mean, I don't think there's anybody out there that would say PTSD doesn't exist. I mean, it took time to get it to be accepted. But with that being accepted, people are willing to look at trauma and different ways of dealing with trauma. Oftentimes the narrative view isn't as accepted as it once was. It's more behavioral types of therapy or body-mind kind of processes, which can be helpful too. But I think that, you know, and the psychiatric, I mean, obviously if you go back to the 1940s and 50s, it was horrible, without a doubt. I mean, we're not in those times, thank goodness, for the most part. And it probably depends on the setting. And I think a lot of times psychiatry is right there where it needs to be and very helpful. You know, I've heard on the internet issues, you know. Keep in mind that when you read a story of a psychiatric abuse, or any sort of abuse, a doctor, a therapist, Child Protective Society, right, CPS, that you're reading one perspective, one side, right?
Right.
Because the other side can't say anything. They're bound by HIPAA, confidentiality laws.
Yeah.
So someone may come forward, they may be telling the truth, they may not. And there's no way you're going to ever know the other side. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So, and I'm not saying the abuses don't exist. I mean, there probably are some real abuses that need to be addressed, you know. But at the same time, you know, they're also, you know, they're also just, it's one person's perspective. So, I don't know. I mean, that may be, people may not agree with me on that, which is okay. But I think it's important to realize that.
There just seems to me to be a lot more official denial in government agencies and in courts about the existence of abuse. Or maybe it's because often the abuser is a high-placed person, and of course we're seeing a different system of justice for insiders versus other people. And so if you've got a well-placed perpetrator, then you're going to see a lot of official denial.
I would agree that money, unfortunately, as you know, is a huge determinator of justice. Unfortunately, not on all cases and always, but when you have the better legal care, the better lawyer, more legal resources, you're going to get more oomph in the court system. You know, I'm not saying it's 100%. Or the only factor, but that would be a big piece of the people who are richer, more connected, like O.J. Simpson's a good example. I mean, he got convicted. He had an incredible legal team. Later on, he just kept making mistakes, and now I think he's in jail for a long time for different things. But, I mean, originally, I mean, there's a good example of a person who, I think he lost the civil case, right? But he won the criminal case, if I remember correctly. And there's a lot of evidence people believe that he did the crime, but, you know, he had a great legal team. So, I think you're right. People are more connected, more wealthy, are more likely to get possibly away with things, possibly, you know, depending on the case.
This is, after all, a crime of abusing one's power, and those who have the most power would seem potentially to be the most dangerous if they misuse it.
And that's often true, too, you know, without a doubt. I mean, a lot of the serial pedophiles are, well, Bill Cosby, an alleged serial rapist, you know. Michael Jackson, you know, alleged serial rapist, and so on. They're very powerful people. Bill Cosby's still very powerful, has a very expensive legal team, media team, too.
I don't know if you had a chance to look at the email I sent you, the link to a Supreme Court of Ohio decision that just came down, I think it was today.
You just sent it to me literally. I will look at it, but you just sent it to me very recently. I'll look at it, though, without a doubt, you know.
Yeah, well, this is pretty disturbing, and this is very much in your face. That on behalf of the highest court in the state of Ohio, has thrown out a law barring police from sex acts with minors. They overturned a conviction of a police officer, age 35, who solicited sex with a 14-year-old.
Wow.
And I guess that they made some sort of an equal protection argument that somehow this was okay.
Here, can I read what you wrote me? We're taking a turn for the worst when the 4th Appellate District protected
sex
offender treatment records.
They had to overturn an intermediate appellate decision in Ohio to do this.
Yeah.
It's
This is
not a deviation, though, for the Ohio Supreme Court. A few years back in NRACP, they took a similar step and refused to require sex offender reporting for a juvenile sex offender who was a pretty active sex offender. Raping and sodomizing.
Are they saying it's prejudicial?
Children.
Is that why you can't bring the records in? Which I don't think I'd agree. I don't like, but
I'm sorry.
Is
what?
Is that the argument they're presenting?
I sent you links to both cases.
Yeah, well, the legal things are very complicated. To me, the most important thing is protecting the children.
Yeah,
I mean, obviously, someone shouldn't be convicted if they're innocent, but if they've committed the crime. I hate to see, if in this case someone really did commit the crime and there's enough evidence, I hate to see legal wrangling occur to let the person possibly not be held responsible. I don't know this case in particular, but I don't think that's right, you know, obviously. I think most people would agree.
These were, in both cases, the acts admittedly occurred.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's a shame. Then if the person isn't held accountable, you know, that's awful, you know. What he did was wrong. So, but yeah, it's unfortunate. I think a lot of times the legal system tries to get it right, but a lot of times it doesn't. Obviously, you know, we see that there's a lot of injustices, and it's bad when children aren't protected due to the injustices.
That's
the real issue.
Because
children
are
defenseless.
There is
you know.
An effort that is ongoing to normalize in the public mind the notion of pedophilia. It's just another sexual orientation.
Yeah, I think there's two sides. I agree there are some people doing that, and that's awful. I think those people are also, fortunately, some people are really slamming them. You know what I mean? You know, saying, oh, no, that's absurd. You know, children cannot consent, and that's it. And that's absolutely true. So, but yeah, I agree with you. There are, unfortunately, proponents in England as well. There's some of that going on, but then there are people coming forward saying, "Oh no, it's not acceptable to lower the age of consent at all." You know, children cannot consent, and that's it.
Courts are doing it. When the courts are part of that effort to to make this seem normal, that's a far more dire situation
absolutely.
Than if you know some news outlet is doing it, or well. They have
if that's what's going on, that's not good if the courts are being a part of that whole thing. You're right.
Right.
So, I mean, then how do you deal with that? Do you get, in the Supreme Court, I don't know, it's hard to remove someone from a Supreme Court, right? At least at the federal level, they're for life, I believe, right? So, if in the state court, would there be a way to deal with that? If you've got people
well, I think
who are doing
we have
that.
To have true accountability of our courts, which you know we should have in the Constitution, which we are not exercising. We're losing a lot of the rights we had at common law for ordinary citizens to say, "Wait a minute, you know, this is wrong," we want you to follow the Constitution.
You make a good point.
Accountable for it.
It's hard to have a true democracy when people aren't properly informed. And that comes back to I write about that, too. That's the whole if you don't have a true democracy with a free flow of accurate information, but instead you have, you know, programmed information, then people aren't going to be able to make the right choices to empower themselves to fix things like this, you know. So, I mean, that's a real good point. You know, we've got to, people need to be informed properly, educated properly, and if not, to think. You know, they have to be taught how to think from day one, not controlled, you know, not manipulated, propagandized, you know, that kind of thing. That's kind of where I'm going with my research at this point. It's looking at the overall picture. Of course, I'm still working hard on the ritual abuse research, but it's more, why is there a backlash against child abuse? You know, stopping child abuse. Why is there a backlash against stopping ritual abuse? You know, more so. Why is there a backlash against dissociative identity disorder? All things that the research strongly backs. You know, child abuse is endemic. Ritual abuse happens a lot, and dissociative identity disorder is a very strong, well-supported diagnosis. And so then, looking at those pieces of why. The it keeps coming back to, well, who benefits? You know, obviously the abusers, but more so those in control. You know, if you expose mind control techniques, propaganda techniques, then those that 1% running the society or less, that small group of people now running the media, most of the media. That most people get on their TV, which is where most people get their news.
We're talking about, you know, like the government's mind control programs that we've been aware of since the 60s, 70s with Dr.
Well,
Ian MKUltra.
Yeah, I mean, you could connect it to all that. I mean, that came out of the, you know, fighting communism supposedly. Well, Operation Paperclip, bringing the Nazis in, who were doing a lot of that research. I mean, and then now it bridges more into, you know, perfecting it, making it more technological. Back then it was more, you know, more primitive in a sense. And that's much more technological with the computer and all the computer information out there and all. But yeah, I mean, I'm bridging it further than that, of course. I'm saying why. As a culture, are we doing this to ritual abuse survivors? Why, as a culture, is there so much denial about child abuse crimes? Still. I mean, you can still go on the internet and there are defenders of Michael Jackson, Bill Cosby, you know, even Jerry Sandusky. It's unreal. You know, so why? I mean, the question is why. Obviously, there's personal denial for some people, too. Or, you know, they could be a member of a religious organization. They feel the religion's being attacked, whether it's the Christian religion or Satanist religion or one of the you know, outside society cults. Mm-hmm. You know, then they'll have a reason to deny what goes on. It gets very complex, as you can see. It gets back to the most important thing is, for me, to make sure the research gets out, that I'm not silenced, that it is available on the internet, that accurate information gets out there, that those trying to distort the information are shown to be distorting it. Their techniques are shown that we do have good research to back up what we say. That comes back to that, you know.
So this is going on not just in the United States. This is going on all over the world too, isn't it? And so is the response, the survivor's response.
Well,
right?
It's hard to know what's going on in non-English speaking countries, but you know there are a lot of. I mean, they've done more research about, for instance, dissociative identity disorder. I mean, one of the false statements made about DID was that it's culture bound. And therefore, it's not real. It's iatrogenic or something, which is not true. There's no evidence to prove that. And but now they're starting to find that the DID does exist in other parts of the world. More and more researchers are doing studies on that. And ritual abuse is the same thing. I mean, obviously Africa, I mean, Africa is well known for all sorts of ritualistic practices. Certain places, I shouldn't say all of it, you know, don't want to be ethnocentric. But in certain countries, there are a lot of kind of ritual kind of crimes that go on. And governments are trying to stop them now, but they're kind of still going on in a lot of areas. I mean, FGM is a good example, you know, of that. And that's it, even, it's in Europe, you know, people, it's been brought to Europe and so on. So, yeah, ritual abuse, you know, as we do more and more research, finding it in more and more places in the world in different ways at times, but it's definitely out there. That's a good question.
So do you think that the internet is more effective in enabling survivors or enabling perpetrators?
I'm not sure what you mean by enabling. Do you mean helping?
Well,
or
making it easier, facilitating.
Making what easier, though? Getting the information out, or
how? Getting information, support, you know, moral support, strategies.
I think that the internet is, I call the internet the wild, wild west.
Right.
Because that's what it is. There's no law. There's very limited
right.
law, I should say. The Communications Decency Act is turned into the opposite, in my opinion. And, you know, and so what we have is people can do pretty much anything they want on the internet, which is unfortunate. I think a lot of people have really been hurt. But the internet can also be an amazing source of information and benefit to society as well. You know, I can type in any country, read a newspaper from around the world almost right away, and it can translate into English, or they may have an English version. Internet used properly is an incredible resource, an incredible library.
Right.
For my work as well. But like I said, I mean, there's, because of the nature of it, lack of accountability, you know, people can do all sorts of terrible things, misrepresent research, you know, attack people, try to destroy people's lives. You know, an example of that is obviously the poor teenagers who, you know, we find out, you know, hurt themselves, kill themselves because of something that went on Facebook or Twitter or whatever, you know, or Snapchat or whatever it is. So, but again, you know, the internet can be a great place as well. Give great support systems, too, for people when used properly.
Are you familiar at all with the work of the various United Nations treaties, like the conventions against torture, or I guess there's a convention against torture that a number of nations have signed on to? Does that address this at all, or is it?
Well, it's not my. I mean, if there's an article, I may cover it, but that's not our. It's a good point, though. Definitely, the human trafficking it definitely connects to our field. A lot of ritual abuse survivors were trafficked. That was why they were ritually abused as an economic
right.
commodity to abuse. They weren't all it wasn't all just government. There were a lot of different types of ritual abuse out there. If you can control a person's mind, make them forget what they did, then that person's ideal to be sexually trafficked, which is awful, but that's what happened. I also deal a lot with on the webpage. I mean, I try to, you know, include whatever fits in my opinion. So that's just the internet being used as a massive source for child abuse at this point. All the dark net kind of pieces going on right now. Every time that's exposed, we try to cover that issue as well. You know, the people going to other countries and Now they're finding in some of the poorer countries, even the families are basically, you know, live streaming abuse of their own children. It's hard, you know, horrible. So, but that's a little bit outside the scope of what we do. But yeah, also very connected. I mean, it's kind of an organized form of abuse, and it's definitely. It's unfortunate.
Is ritual abuse something new in human history, or say in the last 100 years or 50 years, or has it been around longer, do you think?
I think it's been around a long time. Yeah, you know, it's become, it's changed in the way it is. I mean, there's obviously the old-fashioned kind of torture and splitting people's personalities. It's been around a long time. But as also the more scientific, computerized kind of things. There's more of the ritual abuse for the internet, that kind of thing, too.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, yeah, I definitely, there's, it's a story.
It seems like survivor response is relatively a newcomer, though.
Huh?
Is that, and the organized response, like, you know, in the scientific study of it,
yeah,
seems to be relatively.
Well, I think in general, I mean, looking at everything, I mean, women's rights. I mean, they didn't even talk about women's rights till what? Beginning of the 20th century. Stopping rape, even later. Stopping child abuse, what, 1970s? I mean, rights of gay people. Everything is, there's a new awareness. As things get kind of crazier in one way, the awareness is greater in terms of injustices, crimes, you know, against people. So it's a good point. I think that's where I say it's historic, because if you look at the last time, historically, you know, kind of child abuse dissociation kind of crimes became, you know, accepted was around 1890, 1900. You can see that in Freud's writings, The Ideology of Hysteria, I think. And then he kind of did a 180 because the society turned against him and society changed. So then he attributed to all these, you know, theories, Oedipal and all these bizarre kind of things, in my opinion. And so I think a lot of what we do in our field, it's historic. The information comes out in a progressive time and in a darker time where things are more conservative. You know, people are more scared, things are more shut down, the information gets lost again. That's my theory.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the important thing is that we keep the light going, keep the progress going in those darker times.
A spiritual awakening, a huge paradigm shift, do you believe? In the way we think about victimization, in the way we think about, you know, humanity's oldest problem, you know, how to get the oppressor's boot off our neck, one way or the other.
Yeah, I think that's been that's the key. You know, how do we create justice so that people aren't raped and tortured, people aren't taken advantage of, everybody has enough to eat, and children are not abused, you know. I think you're right. So exposing the crimes, breaking the denial, which is what I do with my work, it's big piece. Because if people don't see it and realize it's true, then we can't stop it. You know, if people see it, the research is out there, the stories are out there. Then the next step, people can start taking it to the courts, like, I guess that's what you did. You were the lawyer, right? And other people can, the media can write more about it, have more accurate perspectives on it. And from there, awareness, that's like what happened with the Catholic Church, right? In the 1880s, 1980s and 1990s, there were a few cases here and there, but I think critical mass, I guess, around 2002,
yes.
Right, with the Globe work, Boston Globe work. I mean, that's when everything just boom, at least in the U.S. You know, other countries caught up, and now they're doing their piece, their work. But at that point then, it was, oh, no, that not every priest is good. And the church, we can speak up against the church. And so that's how to get, as you said, the boot off of a person's neck, you know, to reach that point where these crimes are no longer buried, hidden, you know, but accepted as realities. And then action can happen, you know. Now the church, I still think there's still some covering up, obviously, but they're more aware, they're more careful. There's more screening processes and so on. You know, some people disagree with me, but I think there has been some change in the church, not enough, obviously.
Don't you think this is spiritual warfare we're talking about, right?
I don't get into that part so much. I know other people are big on the spiritual. I want to respect them. I look more at psychosocial dynamic. You know, obviously we want people to be good. I see it more as, I do see good and evil, but I see them more in terms of actions. And that's just my belief system. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I respect those who see it differently. That's okay.
Well, faith without works is dead. I think there's got to be works also, and thank God we have people like you who are doing that work and organizing this vast amount of information, growing vaster all the time.
Yeah, I think the key is the faith part is it, for me, is, you know, be a good person, do the right thing, help others, you know, and stand up when you need to stand up to stop a wrong. I mean, that's how it works.
Well, I think, you know, in your website, by gathering all this different kinds of information together, and in the conference, you know, don't you think that each time that folks who are working on this come together, Something new comes out of that. People share their different perspectives, whether they be from law enforcement or
well, yeah, I would agree that you know the more people
community or wherever they're coming from.
The movement has definitely grown because of people working together, because of people working on the research. Those on the mental health side are making a lot of progress on techniques that help people. I'm on the educational and research side, of course, with SMART. On that side, making a lot of progress as to perfecting ways to get the information out, make sure it's accurate, you know, make sure it answers any questions, so on.
I wanted to just ask you, if you could tell us a little bit more about, first of all, is there still room for people who want to sign up and attend the conference?
That's a good question. We should probably finish with that. It's getting late. But yeah, at the website, Ritual, I'm going to read it again, Ritual Abuse, RitualAbuse.us. There's a conference tab on the top. And people can find all the information from the conference. It is in Connecticut. It's in a couple weeks. And there is some room left. And I recommend people email me soon. It's the best way to reach us is Smart News, all one word, smartnews@aol.com. And that's the best way to reach us. And then go into the website, go on the conference tab, and, you know, you'll see... You know, it's a big, long page, but, you know, basically there's information on the conference, where it is, our goals, some of the fees, the speakers, and so on. And you can always email if you have any questions as well. Huh? I'm sorry?
You have this conference every year?
Yes. We've had the conference since, I think, 1997 at this point.
Okay. I'm just reading here. The conference goals are to stop future occurrences of ritual abuse, to help survivors, to to name the groups that have participated in alleged illegal activities and to unite those working to stop ritual abuse.
Right, and that's kind of the goal. People working together at the conference to try to help. You know, the goal of it is to help stop the abuse, but our part is for education. I mean, other people will obviously be doing the mental health piece. Other people may be doing the legal part. There may be police officers involved in dealing with these types of crimes, so lawyers, so on. What we're doing here is it's primarily, again, educational, research-based, getting the information out to the others. And then you see I put down a couple links. One I mentioned, the childabusewiki.org link. And then into information on how to register and so on.
Right, and that's going to be August 13th and 14th.
That's right, in Connecticut. It's near Bradley Airport. I don't know if people know the Northeast at all. People can fly in if they need to. I just recommend, you know, there is a registration process. You have to be approved first. Obviously, a conference like this, we have to screen people, you know, make sure people are safe so that the attendees are safe. But, you know, pre-register, you know, the information on everything is right there. And then if there are any questions people need to ask, they can email me again. The email address is on the page, but it's also smartnews@AOL.com. So.
And anyone can come, right?
Well, the preference is that the person is a survivor or a co-survivor. Obviously, if a person is a perpetrator, then, you know,
right.
We wouldn't want somebody there to take advantage of the people. You know what I'm saying?
That's right.
Or if there was somebody coming there to, I don't know, let's see, there's a caveat somewhere I can read, if I can find it.
Right.
I don't know, maybe we may not have it on this page.
Well,
but basically,
we
you want to make sure everybody's safe.
And,
you know, that's the key. We don't want people at the conference that are going to be hurting survivors. But, you know what I'm saying, right? But other than that, yeah, if you're a survivor, ritual abuse, definitely apply. Write us. If you're co-survivors, if you're a therapist interested, a legal person that's dealing with these type of issues, you know, write us without a doubt. Yeah.
Okay. This,
we'll write
wonderful.
You back
there'll
right
be,
away.
There'll be books on sale, I assume. And
huh?
There'll be books?
Oh, yeah, there'll be books,
speakers.
Definitely. We'll have some books. We'll have literature. There'll be some of the top speakers in the field. Allison Miller, Dr. Miller, Randy Noblet will be doing a presentation.
And it's also sponsored by other organizations, the California Protective Parents
That's
Association.
That's right. Several organizations in the field
are
promotional co-sponsors. They've helped us advertise the conference as well, as you can see.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, Neil Brick, for being on this broadcast of Who Judges the Judges and to tell us more about ritual abuse and what people can do to learn more and to protect themselves. I urge everyone to go to the website, ritualabuse.us, and learn more. Thank you so much.
Hey, thank you, Catherine, for having me on, and you have a good night.
Bye-bye.